Chapter 7. The little girls, stiff with pride and amazement and fairly soused with holy water, were handed into the carriage after pontifical high mass in Lima Cathedral. They smoothed their white dresses, their broad blue mariol sashes, and sat quite straight, looking as happy as was consistent with a high degree of pious awe. They had just heard the tremendous voice of an organ for the first time. They had just been blessed by an archbishop in his mitre. The crowded steps and pavement thinned. The viceroy's splendid coach rolled away, escorted by guards in blue and scarlet, to his palace 50 yards away. The great square became clearly visible.
"There, in the middle, is this splendid fountain of the world," said Sam.
"Yes, father," they replied.
"Do you see the water spouting from the top?" asked Stephen.
"Yes, sir," they answered,
and they ventured no more until they came to Sam's quarters in an arcaded court behind the university, not unlike a quadrangle in one of the smaller Oxford colleges.
"Yes, father."
"Yes, sir,"
was their total response to the news that the fountain was 40 foot high, not counting the figure of fame on the top, that it was surrounded by 24 pieces of artillery and 16 iron chains of unusual weight, that the Casa de la Inquisición had scarcely a rival but the one in Madrid, that 2 of the streets through which they passed had been entirely paved with silver ingots to welcome an earlier viceroy, and that because of the frequent earthquakes, the upper and sometimes the lower floors of the house were built of wooden frames filled with stout reeds, plastered over and painted stone or brick colour, with appropriate lines to help the illusion. That the great thing to do in the event of an earthquake was to open the door, otherwise it might jam and you would be buried under the ruins. They grew a little less shy, a little more human when they were led indoors and fed. Sam's servant, Ippolito, pleased them by wearing a sash broader than their own, but clerical violet. They were delighted to see that the door was indeed kept open by a wedge, and even more so by the discovery of a ludicrous resemblance between Ippolito and Killick. The same look of pinched, shrewish discontent, diffused indignation, the same put-upon air, and the same restless desire to have everything proceed according to his own idea of order. But with this essential difference, that whereas Killick relied on the captain's cook for all but coffee and the simplest breakfast dishes, Ippolito could provide a capital dinner with no more help than a boy to carry plates. This meal, however, being very early and the guests very young, was as plain as well could be. Gazpacho, a dish of fresh anchovies, a paella, with them a little flowery wine from Pisco. Then came fruit, including the Peruvian version of the custard apple, the cherimoya at its best, of which the little girls ate so greedily that they were obliged to be restrained, so greedily that they could manage few of the little almond cakes that would have ended their feast if they had been allowed to remain. But happily, Ippolito had been born old, and neither Sam nor Stephen had any notion of entertaining the young apart from putting volumes of Eusebius on their chairs so that they might dominate their food. Their wine glasses had been regularly filled. They had as regularly emptied them, and when, towards the end of the meal, the boy, standing in the doorway, saw fit to make antic gestures behind his master's back, they were unable to restrain themselves. Stifled laughter swelled to uncontrollable giggles. Neither could look at the other, still less at the boy in the doorway, and both were rather relieved than otherwise when they were turned out into the quadrangle and told to run about and play very quietly until Jemmy Ducks comes to fetch you in the gig.
"I am so sorry, father," said Stephen. "They have never behaved like this before. I should have whipped them had it not been Sunday."
"Not at all, not at all. God love you, sir. It would be the world's pity if they were kept to a Carmelite silence. Sure, a healthy child must laugh from time to time. It would be a dismal existence otherwise. Indeed, they were very good sitting up straight with their napkins held just so."
He passed almond cakes, poured coffee, and went on.
"As for public opinion here in Peru, I should say that there is reasonably strong feeling for independence, particularly as the present viceroy has made some very unpopular decisions in favour of those born in Spain as opposed to those born here. In some cases it is combined with a desire to see the end of slavery, but I do not think this is so much so as it is in Chile. After all, there are perhaps 10 times as many slaves here, and many of the plantations depend entirely on their labour. Yet there are many highly respected, influential men who hate it. I have two friends, two colleagues, who know very much more about the matter than I do. The one is Father O'Higgins, the Vicar General, and my immediate superior. He is very, very kind to me. And the other is Father Inigo Gomez, who lectures on Indian languages in the university. He is descended from one of the great Inca families on his mother's side. You know, I am sure, that there are still many of them, even after the last desperate rising. That is to say, those who were opposed to the rebellious Inca Tupac Amaru, and they still have many followers. Clearly he understands that side better than any Castilian. Should you like to meet them? They are both abolitionists, but they would do their best to speak without prejudice, I have no doubt at all.
The chiming watch in Stephen's fob, so often his conscience before, now warned him once again. He started up, and in a low, hurried voice he said,
"Listen, Sam, I do not wish to abuse your friend's confidence, far less your own. You must know that I am not only bitterly opposed to slavery, but also to the dependence of one country upon another. You may smile, Sam, brought up as you were by Irish missionaries, God be with them, yet I mean the dependence of any country at all upon another. Therefore I may be suspected of political, even subversive, motives by those in authority. Do not run yourself or your friends into danger, for where those who are called intelligence agents or their allies are concerned, the Inquisition is mildness itself in comparison with those who maintain the established order."
He saw the half-suppressed, not wholly unexpected smile on Sam's face, heard him say,
"Doctor, dear, you are beyond measure more candid than the Frenchmen here, the serpents,"
and went on, "But tell me now, Sam, where is the Calle de los Mercadores? If it takes 10 minutes, I shall be 20 minutes late."
"If I let you out by the stable door, it will be the third on your right hand, and I will give the little girls over to the sailor when he comes with the gig."
In spite of his name, Pascual de Gallongas was a Catalan, and when by a series of arbitrary questions and answers Stephen had established his identity, it was in Catalan that he said,
"I had expected you long, long before this." "I regret it extremely," said Stephen. "I was caught up in a particularly interesting conversation. But, my dear sir, does not a long, long time almost border on the excessive for 20 minutes?
"I was not speaking of 20 minutes, no, nor of 20 weeks. These funds have been in my hands for an even greater time."
"Certainly. Some information about our undertaking had been betrayed to Spain,"
Gallongas nodded,
"and it was thought expedient that I should change to another ship, rejoining the Surprise at a stated rendezvous. An intelligent plan, and one that would have caused no great delay, but it did not foresee that this second vessel would be wrecked in a remote part of the East Indies, nor that the inevitable pauses in Java and New South Wales should eat up days, weeks, months that will never return."
"And in that period," said Gallongas, in a discontented voice, "the situation here has changed radically. Chile is now a very much more suitable plan for the enterprise, the whole series of undertakings."
Stephen looked at him attentively. Gallongas was a big, heavy man, well on in middle age. He gave the impression of general greyness, and he was overweight. At this point his fat trembled with passion, fairly well concealed. His commercial dealing had already made him rich. He had nothing to gain, and his motives seemed wholly pure, if indeed hatred could be called pure. Hatred of the Spaniards for their treatment of Catalonia. Hatred of the revolutionary and Bonapartist French for ravaging the country.
"Is government aware of this?"
asked Stephen.
"I have made representations through the usual channels, and I have been told to mind my own business. The Foreign Office knows best."
"I have known the same treatment," Stephen reflected and went on. "But at this point I am necessarily bound by my instructions. Any alteration must take 6 months to reach me, and those 6 months, added to the present delay, will see the decay of the whole structure built up here and in Spain. I shall have to do the best I can, yet at the same time I shall endeavour to avoid committing what we have at our disposal until we see some strong probability of success."
After a silence, Gallongas made a gesture of resignation and said,
"If the Foreign Office were a firm of marine insurers, they would be bankrupt within a year. But it must be as you wish, and I shall arrange the agreed meetings, or at least those that are still of any consequence, as soon as possible. Before we speak of them, be so good as to tell me, very briefly, how the situation has changed.
In the first place, General Mendoza is dead. His horse threw him, and he was picked up dead. He was one of the most popular men in the army, particularly among the Creoles, and he might well have carried half the officers with him. In the second, the Archbishop is now, I hardly like to use the word senile about so good a man and so outspoken an abolitionist, but we are deprived of the full force of his support. In the third place, Juan Muñoz has returned to Spain, and he has been replaced as far as governmental inquiries, secret service, and unavowable activities are concerned by García de Castro, too timid to be equally corrupt and in any event wholly unreliable. Clever, perhaps, but also weak. Terrified of the new viceroy, terrified of losing his place. He is not a man to have anything to do with, near or far.
The absence of Muñoz disturbs me, said Stephen. If Castro has access to his papers, my position is very nearly untenable.
I do not think you should feel anxious, said Gayongas. We did handsomely by Muñoz, and quite apart from the presence, he was wholly on our side. I do not pretend that handsome presence or places in my concerns for his nephew and natural sons did not have their effect on him, but he was not a weak, unprincipled man like this Castro, and he was capable of taking decisive action in support of his friends. The reports about our possible intervention here, never taken very seriously in Madrid, by the way, passed through his hands in the first place, and he virtually smothered them. It was easy enough, since the then viceroy was about to leave, very ill, sick of the country and everything to do with it. And when the surprise appeared, I mean, when she came in first, without you, he went privately down to Callejo, ascertained that she was what she purports to be, a privateer, and had her officially inspected and passed the next day. Before he left Peru, he destroyed a great many files. If any of the more bulky, routine, commonplace, innocuous registers were kept, you would appear only under your name of Domanova. But I very much doubt it, and I do not believe the privateer's captain was ever named at all.
That is comforting, to be sure, said Stephen, cocking his ear to the window.
All over Lima, church and chapel bells began ringing the Angelus, with no more than a few seconds between them, a remarkable medley of tones. Both men crossed themselves and remained silent for a while. Looking up again, Stephen said,
"Except in certain forms, the church is not a well-organized body, scarcely an organized body at all, yet sometimes flashes of sharp, coordinated intelligence pierce through, and they are the more formidable for being unexpected. There is perhaps a certain analogy here with the Spanish government."
Gayongos digested this and then said, "Let us turn to the administration. The new viceroy is not intelligent, but he wished to distinguish himself by being active and zealous. He is wholly committed to the king, quite unapproachable by any means, and so are the people he brought with him, his immediate staff. But fortunately most of the secretariat remains unaltered, and I have some reports that will interest you. As for the chief of office holders, there is little change except at the head of Indian affairs, which is now occupied by a highly respected man, a friend of Humboldt's and like him an abolitionist, while in the department dealing with trade and customs, the deputy controller has taken over from his chief, but he continues the same kindness towards me, and sometimes, with my wide connections, I am able to let him know of a profitable venture as I did for his predecessor."
In a kind of parenthesis, they talked about trade for a while. It was a subject upon which Gayongos, with his correspondents and business associates up and down the Pacific coast and beyond the isthmus, even as far as the United States, was unusually well qualified to speak. He had many activities, but the chief was the insurance of ships and their cargoes, sometimes joining in a scheme he thought unusually sound, and to make a success of these an accurate knowledge of conditions, public feeling, and official intention in the various provinces was of the first importance.
"As I am sure you know,"
he observed. "The governors in all the considerable cities, garrisons, and districts sent confidential reports to the viceroy. It was Munoz who first suggested that we should use them, when I began to let him have a share in some of my undertakings. And now, of the 7 copies made, 1 comes to me as a matter of course. They are particularly interesting at this juncture, since they have an appendix on the political opinion and loyalty of many officers, ecclesiastics, and servants of the crown." He looked at Stephen to see the effect of his words, and with some satisfaction he went on, "This brings us naturally to the army. But before we speak of the soldiers, may I ask whether you know there is a French mission here?"
"I do," said Stephen, smiling. "It would be strange if there were not, but I know only of its existence. Pray tell me what the mission consists of and how they are coming along."
"There are 5 of them, all said to be Swiss, Catholic Swiss. The leader and his brother, the 2 Brissacs, are mathematicians, measuring the force of gravity and the height of various mountains. The other 2 are said to be naturalists. The 5th, who speaks very good Spanish, seems merely to arrange their expeditions. They brought a letter of introduction from Humboldt, or what purported to be a letter of introduction from Humboldt, and they were well received at the university. They are evidently men of considerable learning."
"What progress have they made?"
"Not very much. The elder Brissac, Charles, is a man of real ability, and he has entered into serious conversation with some who are in favour of the new order. But the present French position on slavery cannot please the sort of people he usually sees, who are abolitionists, and he has nothing like enough money to tempt those who are both open to temptation and worth tempting. On the other hand, in spite of everything, there is still a glamour attached to France, and combined with the name of Napoleon and the idea of independence, it moves some young men to a giddy enthusiasm. And the 2 naturalists who appear to have served in the Italian campaign have a number of followers. Castro may be one of them. He often invites the younger, La Trobe, and he arranged for their journey to the place where Humboldt stayed near Quito, so far up in the Andes that you can touch the moon from the ground floor."
"That would have been Antisana for sure, and if I do not mistake, the house is at more than 13,000 feet. If those French agents were not truly devoted naturalists, it must have been the weary, weary climb for them. But Lord, what an opportunity! I long to see the high Andes, to tread the virgin snow and view the condor on her nest, the puma in his lair. I do not mention the higher saxifrages."
"I went to Quito once," said Gayongos, "which is only 9,000 odd. Up and up, always up and up, your lungs bursting, the muscles on your shins on fire, for you often have to lead your mule. Never, never again. I'd rather be taken by the Inquisition. And there, how curious, there, hesitating to cross the street."
They were sitting in a protruding, louvered balcony from which they could see without being seen.
"There, the gentleman in black is a familiar of the Inquisition."
"Yes,
yes, so he is. That reminds me, Castro is a Marano. His great-grandmother was a Toledo Jewess, and perhaps that is what makes him so anxious to be cherished by the viceroy, while at the same time he longs to ensure himself on the other side."
"A difficult position," observed Stephen. "A Marano cannot afford to make enemies. One alleged dislike of pork, 1 7-branched candlestick found in his house, no matter who put it there, and the familiars come for him. He is accused of Hebrew practices, and you know the rest. Castro had much better keep quiet."
"Castro is not capable of keeping quiet," said Gayongas.
And from that they went on to discuss the soldiers. It appeared from Gayongas's informed comments and from his appendices that there was a considerable amount of idealism and of support for independence, particularly among the captains and lieutenants. The senior officers were, for the most part, chiefly concerned with power and personal advantage, and they tended to hate one another.
"There are already bitter quarrels about how various commands and ministries are to be shared out," said Gayongas. but he also vouched for three relatively disinterested generals and stated that if they were properly approached, they might move in concert and precipitate the revolution. This would be all the more feasible if they were supplied with donatives to win the support of 5 or 6 regiments in key positions.
"This we can afford to do," said Gayongos, "whereas the French cannot. Yet these are difficult, imperious men, and the presentation of the scheme is of the very first importance. And in any case it is you who have to decide on their value and on the present situation. General Hurtado is by far the most influential, and he is in Lima at present. Should you like to go shooting with him early on Friday morning?"
"Very much. It would, I think, be indiscreet to ask to borrow your confidential reports."
"They are indeed very bulky, and although I could explain their presence, no one else outside the palace could do so. May I look through them for some particular point?"
"I should be interested in any recent mention of Father O'Higgins, the Vicar General, of Father Gomez, and of Father Panda."
"Now that the Archbishop is failing, the Vicar General is the most important man in the diocese. He is an abolitionist, and he would be entirely on our side, but for the fact that he deplores violence, and that the English are for the most part heretics. Father Panda, a tall African, is his confidential assistant. He does not seem to mind violence nearly so much. Although he is so young, they say he is very well seen in Rome, and is likely to be a prelate soon. The Vicar General thinks the world of him. He, too, is an abolitionist, of course. Of Father Gomez, I only know that he is descended from Pachacutec Inca, that he is much revered by the Indians, and that he is very learned, which is not my line at all."
"I believe I shall meet them privately quite soon."
"Very good," said Gayongus. "And for these gentlemen?"
He held up his list of agreed meetings.
"General Hurtado on Friday morning, by all means, but it might be wiser to give the Vicar General priority over the others, to see them having learnt his views."
"Very much wiser."
There seemed little more to be said at this first interview, apart from settling the place and time of Friday's expedition. But after a moment, Gayongas said,
"This may be an absurd suggestion. It is most unlikely that you should have the time. But you said you longed to see the high Andes, Antisana, Cotopaxi, Chimborazo, and the like. Now I shall presently have messengers going to Panama and Chagres by way of Quito. I should in any case have offered their services for any letters you might wish to have sent from the Atlantic side of the isthmus. But it occurs to me that some of these interviews may take a long while to arrange, a long while for emissaries to come and go. Potosi, Cuzco, for example, and that possibly you might find time to travel with them as far as Quito, reliable men who know the road, and who could show you prodigious prospects of snow, rock and ice, volcanoes, bears, guanacos, vicuñas, eagles."
"You tempt me strangely. I wish it could be so. I dearly love a mountain," said Stephen. "But I could not square it with my conscience. No, I'm afraid it will have to wait until our design is carried out. But I shall certainly burden your people with my letters, if I may. Many, many thanks to you, my dear sir."
For days the wind had kept in the east, and by now there was a considerable sea running across the northward current, causing the Franklin to roll and pitch rather more than was comfortable, rather more than was usual for mustering the ship's company by divisions. But this was Sunday, the first Sunday that Jack had felt reasonably sure that his wounded leg would bear the exercise, and he decided to carry on. At breakfast, the word had been passed, "Clean to muster," and now the boatswain was bawling down the hatchways,
"D'ye hear there, fore and aft? Clear for muster at 5 bells, duck frocks and white trousers."
While his only remaining mate roared,
"D'ye hear there, clean shirts and shave for muster at 5 bells.
Many of the seamen were, of course, old surprises. For them all this was part of immemorial custom, as much part of natural life as dried peas on Wednesday, Thursday and Friday. And they had already washed their best shirts in readiness, while on Saturday evening or early on Sunday they had combed out their pigtails and replaited them each man for his time-mate, before or after cornering the ship's barber for their shave. Now, apart from fitting the poor bewildered blacks into their purses' slops, brushing and tidying them as well as they could, and comforting them by calling out, "It's all right, mate, never fret," and patting them on the back or shoulders, they were quite ready. So was their captain. He was about to pull on his ceremonial breeches when, through the open door, Killick cried,
"No, you don't. Oh, no, you don't, sir. Not since you have looked at those there wounds and at their eye. It was the doctor's orders, sir, which you cannot deny it, and orders is orders."
He had an overwhelming moral advantage, and Jack sat down, showing his thigh. A damned great slit that had been very painful at first, but that had healed to a fair extent, just as his scalp had done, though walking was still awkward. Unwillingly, Killick admitted that they needed no more than the ointment, but when he unrolled the bandage covering the captain's eye, he cried,
"Now we shall have to have the drops as well as the salve. A horrid sight, like a poached egg, only bloody. And I'll tell you what, sir, I shall put a little Gregory into the drops."
"How do you mean, Gregory?"
"Why, everybody knows Gregory's patent liquid, sir. It rectifies the humours, and don't these humours want rectifying? Oh, no, not at all. I've never seen anything so ugly. God love us."
"Did the doctor mention Gregory's patent liquid?"
"Which I puts him on Barrett Bondon's wound, a horrible great gash, like a butcher's shop. And look at it now, as clean as a whistle. Come on, sir, never mind the smart. It is all for your own good."
"A very little, then,"
said Jack, who had in fact known of Gregory's liquid, together with Harris's guaranteed unguent, Carey's warranted arrowroot, brimstone and treacle on Friday, and other staples of domestic medicine, all as much a part of daily life on land as hardtack and mustering by divisions on Sunday at sea. With his hat very carefully arranged over his new bandage, for in spite of his innumerable faults Killick did not lack a kind of sparse tenderness, Jack made his way up the companion ladder at half a glass before five bells in the forenoon watch, hauling himself up step by step. It was an exceptionally beautiful day, brilliant, cloudless, with the immense sky a deeper, more uniform blue than usual, and the sea, where it was not chopped white, an even deeper shade, the true imperial blue. The wind was still due east, singing quite loud in the rigging, but although the Franklin could have spread to gantsels, she was in fact lying to, bowing the uneven seas with her main topsail aback and a balancing mizzen. Under her lee lay her most recent prize, a fur trader down from the north, a fat, comfortable vessel, but naturally so unweatherly and now so foul-bottomed as well that she was utterly incapable of working to windward at all, and Captain Aubrey was waiting for the return of the south-east or south-south-east trade to see her in. She carried no extraordinary cargo. She had meant to fill up her hold with sealskin down at Masafuero, but those surprises, and there were several of them, who had been on the Nootka run and who had conversed with their prisoners, knew that in sea-otter skins and beaver alone the able seaman's share of the prize would be in the nature of 93 pieces of 8, and it was a cheerful ship that her captain was now about to inspect. The starboard watch had already brought up their clothes bags, arranging them in a low pyramid on the booms, and the larbolins were laying theirs in a neat square far aft on the quarter-deck when Jack appeared. As he had done a thousand times on such occasions, he cast an eye at the sea, the sky, and the ship's trim. Literally, an eye. For even if the other had not been hidden by a bandage, it could not bear this brilliant light, whilst in the dimness of his sleeping cabin its sight was troubled, uncertain. He also absorbed the mood of the ship's company, and in spite of the severe indwelling pain and anxiety, some of their cheerfulness came into his mood. Five bells, and he nodded to Veedle, the acting first lieutenant, who cried, "Beat to divisions!" So many people were away in various ships that the order did not run down the usual series of repetitions, but came into instant effect with the thunder of the roaring drum. The recently promoted stop-gap officers, most of them Shelmerstonian master mariners in their own right, reported that their divisions were present, properly dressed and clean. Veedle crossed the deck, took off his hat, and said, "All the officers have reported, sir."
"We will go round the ship, then, if you please,"
replied Jack. And round they went in the traditional manner, except that Bondon, as captain's coxswain, accompanied them in case of a false step on the blind side. For though Bondon's ribs and breastbone had been exposed to public view in the taking of the Alastor, his wound had healed fast, and his friends had taken seaman-like steps to ensure that it should not open again. First a girth of linen rubbed with hog's lard, then two of number 8 sailcloth, then the same of number 4, and over all a span-broad white marlin plait ending in stout nittles that could be and were hauled taut with a heaver, so taut that he could breathe only with his belly. The afterguard and waisters under Slade formed the first division, and here were most of the Alistair's black slaves. Naturally enough, since they were the merest landsmen, useful only for holystoning the deck in smooth weather, swabbing and sweeping it, or hauling on a rope under strict supervision. Abruptly, Jack found that he did not know their names, could not tell one from another, and was unable to exchange the usual word. They were beautifully clean, shining clean, and perfectly dressed in their new duck frocks and trousers, and they had been taught to stand up and pull off their hats. But they looked nervous, far from happy. Their eyes rolled with apprehension. The next group had two more, as well as some remaining Franklins, and although Jack knew the white men tolerably well, he was surprised to see them in this division. But the people under his command had necessarily been given such different duties and moved to and fro between such different ships that even a captain who had not been knocked on the head and obliged to keep his cabin for some time might have been confused. It was better when he came to the gunners and the forecastlemen, the oldest hands aboard, ludicrously under Reed, whose voice had not yet finished breaking, but Jack was still worried when he went below with his escort to inspect the galley, the berth deck, and all the rest. He had always felt that it was an officer's absolute duty to know all his men, their watch, rating, abilities, and of course their name and division. He, Veedle, and Bondon at length returned to the daylight, filed past the remaining seamen prisoners, and so to the leeward side of the quarter-deck, where the captured officers stood.
"It is a pleasure to see you walking about and looking so well, sir," said one of them.
"You're very good," replied Jack.
Then, conscious of an absence, he ran his eye sharply over the little band and cried,
"Where is Mr. Dutour?" "Bondon, jump down to his cabin and rouse him out. Find his servant!"
There was no Dutour, nor could his servant be found, though the ship, the prize, and the schooner-rigged launch towing astern were searched through and through, with all the skill of those accustomed to hiding goods from customs officers and men from impressment. His sea-chest, with a plate reading Jean Dutour, was in his cabin, and all his clothes. His writing-desk, open and disordered, with some papers presumably taken from it, but his purse, which Jack had restored, was not to be seen. The testimonies were extraordinarily varied. They agreed only in that Dutour had not dined in the gunroom for quite a while and that he had seemed to be offended, was thought to be messing by himself. But how long that time was, no one could tell for certain. Even Killick, the most inquisitive man aboard, had no sure, clearly dated knowledge, and to Jack's astonishment, he was not even aware that Dutour had been refused leave to go to Callao in the surprise with his former shipmates, did not even know that he had asked for permission. No one could swear to having seen him on the quarter-deck after the Franklin had parted company. None could swear to the contrary. Most had the impression that he was keeping his cabin, studying or sick. There were several possibilities, and Jack turned them over in his mind as he sat, alone at last, in the Franklin's stern window. Dutour might have brought his belongings over from the surprise to the Franklin, returning on some pretext and there concealing himself. He might have walked into the Alistair when she was alongside, transferring stores. The same applied to the whaler. And there was the launch, sent in to bring hands from Callao. It was the outcome that really mattered, however. In his reserved way, Stephen had said that sending Dutour in to Callao might be impolitic, and there was no doubt that Dutour was in Callao at this moment.
"Pass the word for Mr. Veedle," he called,
and when Veedle came...
"Sit down, Mr. Veedle. Who took the launch into Callao?"
"I did, sir," said Veedle, changing colour.
"How did she handle?"
"Sir?"
"How did she handle? Is she a weatherly boat? Does she hold a good wind?"
"Yes, sir. She points out very close indeed. Makes almost no leeway, close-hauled. A jewel of her."
His voice died away.
"Very well. Pray have her victualled and stored, with masts stepped, before the first dog."
"Craft," said Veedle, finishing his words.
"Do not let them forget fishing tackle and a casting net. It may take 2 or 3 days to beat in if this wind don't change. I shall take Bondon, Killick, Place, William Johnson. And you're Ben?"
The last he named after an infinitesimal pause, for while they were speaking he had come to an intimate conviction that Dutor had gone ashore in the schooner, and that taking Ben would, if nothing else, prevent any foolish action on Vidal's part. It might have been wiser to take Vidal himself, but with so many of the most responsible and experienced men away or wounded, Vidal was by far the best to leave in charge. He might have chapelish, democratic, even republican views, but he had been the master of a ship larger than the Franklin. He was a prime seaman, thoroughly respected, and he had a large following.
"You will take command while I am away," he said after a silence. "If the wind keeps in the east, as I believe it will, you will not be able to carry the prize a single mile nearer Callao, though you beat up day and night. Should it change, you may come in, and if you cannot fetch Callao, we will rendezvous off the Chinchas. But I shall give you your orders in writing, together with a list of meeting places from the Lobos Rock far to the southward."
Indeed, to make any real progress in a breeze as strong and steady as this, a vessel had to be rigged fore and aft, and nothing could have been more wholly fore and aft than the Alastor's elegant mahogany launch with her remarkably flat-cut sails. In spite of his deep uneasiness, Jack took a pleasure in getting all that he could from her, bringing her up to the very edge of shivering, falling off just that much and sending her fast through the coming sea. The launch was as responsive as a well-mannered, spirited horse. It was beamy and stiff enough for this kind of weather, and well before nightfall they had sunk the Franklin's topsails in the west. When Jack Aubrey was strongly moved, he seemed to grow taller and broader-shouldered, while without the slightest affectation or morosity his ordinarily good-humoured expression became remote. Killick was not easily put down. Ordinary fits of anger over dropped bottles, inept orders from Whitehall or the flag left him totally unmoved. So did reproach, and even abuse. But this rare, particular gravity intimidated him. And when he dressed leg, eye, and scalp that evening, he did so with no more words than were necessary, and those uttered meekly. The decked part of the launch was divided fore and aft into two long cuddies, each with headroom enough to sit up. It was here that Jack stretched out on a mattress over the grating a little after the setting of the watch. Although the forward part of the cuddy was filled with canvas and cordage, there was plenty of room for him, and according to his lifelong habit, he fell asleep within minutes, in spite of pain and anxiety. His neighbours in the larboard cuddy, Johnson and young Ben Vidal, did much the same. Johnson, a black man from the Seven Dials, began telling Ben about his triumph over the whoreson pinchfart master-at-arms in Bellerophon, when first he went to sea. But his voice dwindled when he found he had no hearer. It had been laid down that they should be at watch and watch, and a few minutes before midnight Jack woke straight out of what had seemed a deep and dreamless sleep. Yet some parts of his mind must have been active, since he knew perfectly well that the launch had gone about four times, and that the wind had diminished to a moderate breeze. He made his way out of the cuddy into the light of the moon, a true clock if one knew her age and her exact place among the stars for the beginning of each watch. Suddenly, as he stood there swaying to the quieter sea and wishing he could stretch over the lee rail and dash water into his face, it occurred to him that his eye scarcely hurt at all. There was still a certain irritation, but the deep pain was not there.
"By God," he said, "perhaps I shall be able to swim again in a week or two."
"You are a good relief, sir," said Bondon, yielding the tiller. And he gave an exact account of the courses steered, two reaches as near southeast by east as possible, and two northeast by east, and their speed rising to 10 knots, 1 fathom, now that the head seas had grown less lumpish. Behind them there was the muffled sound of the changing watch, the very small watch, and Jack said,
"Well, turn in, Bondon, and get what sleep you can."
He settled into the helmsman's place with a living tiller under his hand and forearm, and while his companions pumped and baled the launch dry, a good deal of water had come aboard earlier, but now there was no more than the odd waft of spray, his mind moved back to its essential preoccupations. His moral conviction that Vidal had been party to Dutor's escape was irrational, in that it was based on no more than an instinctive distrust of Vidal's first reply. But now that he reflected, gathering all he had ever heard of Dutor's views, and those of the Nipperdollings, all that he knew about enthusiasm and the lengths to which it might lead the enthusiast, it appeared to him that here reason and instinct coincided,
as they sometimes did when he fought a battle over again in recollection, or at least those phases such as boarding and the hand-to-hand encounter in which there was really no time for deliberation, no time at all. And his reflecting mind approved of his having been here in the launch. It might do great good. It would do no harm at all. Yet how Dutton had managed to get away was scarcely worth pondering about for any length of time. All that signified was that he had got away, and that Stephen had said he should be kept aboard. From my point of view, it might be impolitic for him to be set ashore in Peru. Stephen's point of view had, of course, to do with intelligence, as Jack knew very well. During an earlier voyage, he had seen him drop a box which, bursting, revealed a sum so vast that it could only have been intended for the subversion of a government, and he strongly suspected him of having dished two English traitors, Ledwood and Ray, attached to a French mission to the Sultan of Prabang. In a parenthesis, he heard Stephen's voice. "Tell me, Jack, my dear, is dish a nautical term?"
"We often use it in the Navy," Jack replied. "It means to ruin or frustrate or even destroy. Sometimes we say scupper, and there are coarser words, but I shall not embarrass you by repeating them."
On the windward bow, Canopus was just clearing the horizon.
"Stand by to go about,"
he called, and his companions ran to their stations. He eased off half a point, cried,
"Helm's alee,"
and ducking under the boom, he brought the launch round in a true smooth curve, filling with barely a check on the starboard tack. The moon was lowering now, and dimmed by a high veil she gave so little light that he scarcely saw Johnson come aft.
"Shall I spell you now, sir?"
he asked, and his teeth showed in the darkness.
"Why, no thank you, Johnson," said Jack. "I shall sit here for a while."
The launch sailed on and on, almost steering herself as the breeze grew lighter, and as the seas declined, no breaking crests at all, so the water became alive with phosphorescence, a pale fire streaming away and away in her wake, but also gleaming in vast amorphous bodies at depths of perhaps 10 or even 20 fathoms, and at various levels the movement of fishes could be seen, interweaving lanes or sudden flashes. Jack returned to his reflections. Stephen's point of view had, of course, to do with intelligence. This had almost certainly been the case for many, many years, and on occasion Jack had been officially required to seek his advice on political matters. But he had no notion of Stephen's present task. He did not wish to know either, ignorance being the surest guarantee of discretion. Nor could he imagine how such a man as Dutton could be any hindrance to whatever task it was. Surely no government, however besotted, could ever think of using such a prating, silly fellow as an intelligence agent, or any sort of envoy. He turned the matter over this way and that. It was an exercise as useful as trying to solve an equation with innumerable terms of which only two could be read. To windward there was a vast expiring sigh as a sperm whale surfaced, black in a coruscation of green light, an enormous solitary bull. His spout drifted across the launch itself, and he could be heard drawing in the air, breathing for quite some time. Then, easily, smoothly, he shouldered over and dived, showing his flukes in a final blaze. Jack continued with his pointless exercise, with one pause when Johnson spelled him until the end of the watch, ending with no more valuable observation than that with which he had begun. If Dutton was in any way a threat to Stephen on shore, it was his clear, self-evident duty to get the man aboard again if it could be done, and if it could not, then at least to take Stephen off. From the end of the watch at 4, he slept until 6, blessing himself for this eye, but uneasy about the failing breeze, still right in their teeth, but barely carrying the launch close-hauled at more than 5 knots, and they measured by a hopeful mind. It did not surprise him to wake to a calm, but for a moment he was surprised by the strong smell of frying fish. There was still an hour to go before breakfast.
"Good morning, sir," said Killick, creeping in with his dressings. "Flat calm and an oily swell."
But this he said without his usual satisfaction in bringing unwelcome news, and he went on,
"Which Joe Place asks pardon, but could not help having a cast, and breakfast will be ready in 10 minutes. It would be a shame to let it grow cold."
"Then bring me the hot water, and as soon as I am shaved I shall come on deck. You can do my eye afterwards. It is much better.
I knew as how Gregory would do it, cried Killick, a look of triumphant happiness on his face. I shall double the dose. I knew I was right. It rectifies the humours, you understand.
Joe Place, a steady forecastle hand, was good at all the countless skills required of an able seaman, but he was an absolute artist in the use of a casting net. Poised on the bowsprit, with his left hand on the stay, he swung the net with his right, throwing it with an exactly calculated twist that spread its weighted edge so that the whole fell flat as a disc on the surface, just over one of the countless bands of anchovies that surrounded the launch for miles in every direction. The little fishes stared in amazement or even tried to leap upwards. The weights quickly carried the edge of the net down and inwards. A string drew them together, and the imprisoned fish were drawn aboard. Half the first cast had been eaten by the helmsman, who was always fed first. The second half and two more were eaten fresh and fresh by all hands, sitting on the deck round a large pan, itself poised over charcoal on a raised iron plate.
"My God, this is good!"
said Jack, sweeping up the juice with his biscuit.
"There is nothing better than your really fresh anchovy."
"It must die in the pan," observed Place. "It is deadly poison else."
There was a general murmur of assent.
"Very true,"
said Jack.
"But I'll tell you what, shipmates," he went on, nodding towards the east-southeast, "you'd better blow your kites out. You'd better eat all you can, because God knows when you will have another hot meal, or a cold one, for that matter. Ben, do you know what a windgall is?"
The very young man blushed, choked on his fish, and in a strained voice, looking nervously at his companions, said,
"Well, sir, I've seen the ordinary kind."
"Look out to leeward, a little afore the beam, and you will see one a long way out of the ordinary."
"It was not there when we set to breakfast," said Joe Place. "And to leeward, too. Oh, dear," said Johnson. "God bless us."
"Amen," said the others.
Far over, in the ill-defined region between sea and sky, there was an iridescent patch, roughly oval, of the size that an outstretched hand might cover. And its colours, sometimes faint, sometimes surprisingly vivid, shifted right through the spectrum.
"A windgall to windward means rain, as you know very well," said Jack. "But a windgall to leeward means very dirty weather indeed. So, Joe, you'd better make another cast. Let us eat while we can."
The other sea creatures were of the same opinion. The launch was now in the middle of the northward-flowing Peruvian current, and for some reason the animalculae that lived there had begun one of those immense increases in population that can colour the whole sea red, or make it as turbid as pea soup. The anchovies, blind with greed, devoured huge quantities. Medium-sized fishes and squids ate the anchovies with reckless abandon, scarcely aware that they themselves were being preyed upon by fishes much larger than themselves. The bonitos and their kind, by sea lions, by great flights of pelicans, boobies, cormorants, gulls, at a singularly beautiful turn, while agile penguins raced along just beneath the surface. The launch's crew spent most of the forenoon making all fast, sending up preventer stays and shrouds, and preparing what number one canvas they possessed. A little before dinner time, when a tall white rock, a sea lion's island much haunted by birds, the sea mark for Callao Head, showed plain on the starboard bow, nicking the horizon 10 miles away, with a remote, almost cloud-like snow-topped Andes far beyond, the wind began blowing out of a clear, high, pale blue sky. It could be seen coming, a dun-coloured haze from the east, right offshore. But it did not come with any sudden violence, but it increased steadily to a shrieking blast that flattened the sea, bringing with it great quantities of very fine sand and dust that gritted between their teeth and blurred their sight. In the interval between the first pleasant hum in the rigging that woke the launch to life and the scream that overcame everything but a shout, they came abreast of the tall white rock. Jack at the tiller, all hands leaning out far to windward to balance the boat, and the launch tearing through the water at a pace somewhere between nightmare and ecstasy. As they passed under the lee of the island, they heard the sea lions barking, and young Ben laughed aloud.
"You would laugh the other side of your face, young fellow, if you could feel how this goddamn tiller works with a strain," said Jack to himself.
And he noticed that Place was looking very grave indeed. Joe Place, he reflected, must be close on 60, much battered in the wars.
And now, at last, the wind was working up an ugly sea. The waves had no great fetch, and they were short and steep, growing rapidly steeper, with their crests streaming off before them. As soon as the boat was past the rock, it was clear that she could not go on under this press of sail. The seaman looked aft. Jack nodded. No word passed, but all moving together, they carried out the perilous manoeuvre of wearing, carrying the launch back into the lee, there close reefing the main and foresail, sending up a storm of forestaysail, and creeping out to sea again. For the rest of daylight, and brilliant daylight it was, with never a cloud to be seen, this answered well enough, and they supped by watches on biscuit and oatmeal beaten up with sugar and water. A grog, of course, served out by Captain Aubrey. There was even enough of a pause for Killick to dress Jack's eye, and to tell him he would certainly lose it if he did not put back to the barkie, where it could be kept dry.
"Nonsense," said Jack. "It is much better. I can see perfectly well. It is only the bright light I cannot stand."
"Then at least let me cut a patch out of the flap of your hat, sir, so you can wear the two together like Lord Nelson, tied over your head with a scarf if it blows."
It blew. The patch was barely on before the making of it would have been impossible. The voice of the wind in the rigging rose half an octave in half an hour, and the boat was flung about with shocking violence. Most of that night they were obliged to lie to under a storm trysail and a scrap of the jib. A night of brilliant moon beaming over a sea white from horizon to horizon. Tomorrow it must blow out, they said. But it did not. The days followed one another and the nights, everything on the point of carrying away, a perpetual series of crises. Sometimes they advanced until they were in sight of the island guarding Callao and the cliffs, sometimes they were beaten back, and presently, though this was approaching the austral midsummer, the wind, blowing off the high Cordillera, grew perishing cold to those who were always dripping wet. Wet, and now hungry. The unhappy Ben contrived not only to scrape his shins to the bone, but also to lose their precious keg of oatmeal overboard, and on Thursday their rations were cut by half. When Jack announced this in a shout as they huddled together in the starboard cuddy, he added the ritual,
"Two upon four of us. Thank God there are no more of us."
And he was pleased to see an answering smile upon those worn, cruelly tired faces. But there was no smile on Sunday, when at dawn they heard the sea lions quite close at hand, and realized that they had been driven back, for the seventh time, by a wind that was stronger still and even growing, a wind that must have blown the Franklin and her prize far, far into the Western Ocean.